Today is Monday, May 22nd. We're going to be working more on chemistry information. Just a reminder, there's no class on Wednesday, and on Monday, Memorial Day. So what I'd like to do is take you back a little bit into Monday's class and talk to you about some last Monday's and last Wednesday's class and talk to you about some chemical information. Let's take a look at this snapshot of the periodic table. Out of all these elements listed here, can you tell me which one is the most common element? Oxygen, yeah, at about 60-some percent of your body's mass, oxygen is the most common element. Can you tell me the top four most common elements? Good, yeah, chon or honk, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, good, that grabs all four. Can you tell me the name of the element that has 7 as its atomic number?
Nitrogen,
good. And of course, that's represented by what letter?
N,
good. Can you tell me how many neutrons the nitrogen on our periodic table should carry?
7.
Good. Can you tell me, say, for phosphorus, what is the number of protons in an atom?
15.
Good. Phosphorus has what symbol?
P.
P. Good. Let's see. For oxygen, can you tell me how many electrons?
8.
8. Good. Now, how many of those are in the valence shell?
6.
There's
6 in the valence
shell. 6. Okay. So just to make sure we got that part straight. Okay, so oxygen would, of course, have how many in the innermost orbital?
2.
Okay. And how many electrons total?
8.
6.
You got it. 6 in that outermost or valence shell. Okay. So just thinking about oxygen for a moment, would you consider it to be neutral?
Yes.
No. It would be neutral.
Oh, yeah.
Neutral means the same numbers of good. Yeah, this one in fact is neutral. It has same numbers of protons and electrons. Different question entirely. Is this one stable or reactive?
Reactive.
It's reactive. Good. Meaning what?
It's not
does it satisfy the octet rule? Doesn't have 8. Okay. So there's room for 2 more we can hold here if we were to do a covalent bond, a transfer, whatever may happen to satisfy that octet rule. Okay.
So neutral means it's the same number of protons and neutrons.
That's right. So protons and
electrons.
Okay. So neutral atom, it just happens to be reactive, not stable. Okay. Let's pick on another one up there. Let's see. Carbon has how many electrons in its valence shell?
4.
Good. So it's got 6 total electrons, 2 in the innermost, and then 4 in that outermost shell. Good. Let's see what we've got here. What is the symbol for potassium?
K.
K, good. Let's see, how many electrons in a sodium atom?
11,
good. Let's see, how many protons in a potassium atom?
19,
good. And for calcium, how many neutrons?
20.
Yeah. So, yeah, of course, 40 there. We'll just round to 40 and then minus 20. So that gives you about 20 neutrons there. Okay. How you feel about this atomic number, mass, proton, neutron, electron stuff? Feeling pretty good? Okay. Anything I can clarify for you? So how is it that isotopes have something in common? What do they share in common? Good, same element, same number of protons, but they have different numbers of
neutrons.
Good. And of course, if you change the neutron number, what also changes?
The mass.
The mass, right, good. So all of these are carbon atoms. I know it says it on the bottom of the screen, but if it didn't say that, how would you count and confirm that these are all the same element?
Yeah, same number of protons. They all have 6 positive charges, and of course that is the proton number for that atom. Okay, so even if it didn't say it along the bottom, you could say, ah, they're all isotopes of the same element. All right, so are all of these neutral?
Yes.
Yes. 6 protons and 6 electrons. Good. Yeah, they're all neutral. Are they all stable?
No.
They're all reactive. Yeah, all of them have, looks like, what, 4 electrons? Yeah, so all of them are going to be reactive, looking for a way to stabilize and satisfy that what rule? Octet rule. Good. Okay. Speaking of rules, here's another one. We know that atoms form bonds to help satisfy that octet rule. And so in the before picture, you'll notice that we had, you know, reactive atoms. After the bond has taken place, what happens to the valence shell?
One gains an electron, the other one loses. They follow, one follows the duet rule, the other one follows the octet rule.
Good. One's got the duet rule satisfied, and the other one satisfies the octet rule. Good. Can you tell me in this picture, the after picture, which one is your cation?
Three.
Good. How do you know that's the cation? Good. Got more protons than electrons. It gave away an electron. So, of course, there it sits on the neighboring valence shell. Because the neighbor gained an electron, what name do we apply to it?
Anion.
Anion, good. Are ions neutral?
No.
They're not. Good. They're not neutral. How do you confirm that they're not neutral?
Charges.
Yeah, count their charges. They are not equal, so you should have 3 positive protons. Excuse me. Had this one been a neutral atom, you would have had 3 negative electrons, but it doesn't work out that way. The neighbor should have had 9 positive protons and 9 negative electrons, but again, looks like we've got an extra electron over there. So count the charges and see if there's actually a neutral set. When there's been a transfer, you're going to unbalance that neutrality rule. Okay, so what is it that ions do with their electrons? Share them or transfer them?
Transfer
them, good. How does a covalent bond take place?
Share
electrons, good. If there are no delta symbols, do we have a polar or a nonpolar bond?
Nonpolar,
good. So, of course, this one here is polar because you've got delta symbols. What do the delta symbols represent as happening in the bond?
Unequal sharing.
Unequal sharing, good. And in the case of water, which is our classic polar example, which atom is being more greedy with those electrons?
Oxygen,
right. It's taking its time with those orbiting electrons. Okay, so that's kind of what we covered in here last Monday and Wednesday. Do y'all have any questions so far on all this chemistry stuff? Okay, let's see. We were talking in class Wednesday about some chemistry and some reactions. So I'd like to take you back to the very last thing that we discussed, which is a neutralization reaction on the top of page 17. Neutralization on the top of page 17. So when we think about neutralization reactions, we think about our blood pH. We know that blood pH is slightly basic and it falls between a very narrow range. What is that range?
7.35.
Good, 7.35 to 7.45. And neutralization reactions help us to nudge that blood pH back in that narrow range. So when you're looking at a reaction, trying to determine if it's neutralization or not, there's a couple of things we should look for. The reactants of a neutralization reaction are always what and what?
An acid and a base.
Acid and a base, good. Just using some shortcut chemistry knowledge, how do you know that this one here, NaOH, is a base?
Because it has a hydroxyl. Yeah, good.
That OH on the end, the hydroxide or hydroxyl, is our clue. Most bases have an OH at the back end of their compound formula. All right, so that's good to know. And then acids, how do we know that this one is an acid?
It's got hydrogen.
Hydrogen, good. So general rule of thumb is, of course, look for the hydrogen at the front end for an acid and an OH at the rear end for a base. And then you look at water and say, well, water's not an acid, right? Okay, even though it has hydrogens in the front of the compound, this is one of our rule breakers here. It does not follow that general rule. We just have to keep in mind that H2O is a product of a neutralization reaction. And we know that water is neutral on that pH scale. The other product here that we see as a result of a neutralization reaction is salt. So are salts acids or bases? Or neither?
Neither.
Neither, good. So do you see any OH or hydroxides in the NaCl compound? Okay, so you can say, check, that's not a base. Do you see any hydrogens in the front of the compound?
No.
Okay, so check, it's not an acid. That leaves us with saying, okay, this one probably is a salt because it has neither the hydrogens nor the hydroxides that we would expect to see in an acid or a base. What you can say about that salt is it's an electrolyte. It will break apart into its sodium and chlorine components, and those two can conduct electricity. That's what electrolytes do. They conduct an electrical message throughout our bodies. Okay. So that's kind of where we were. Let's talk about today's material, about halfway down your page. Do you have any questions before we get started with the new stuff? Okay, so to start off with the new stuff, let's talk about monomers versus polymers. We're going to talk about baby toys for just a moment. Okay, so these are all colored differently, which helps us to appreciate that this particular baby toy is built from building blocks or monomers. And if you take these parts apart, all I've got is a single unit here. So these single units have been joined together to make a longer unit. This longer unit is called a what?
Polymer.
Good. Now, technically, to be a polymer, all you have to have is two. Now, if you want to be specific, it's a dimer, you know, meaning two units together. But it still fits the bill for what a polymer is. It's two or more units linked together. So, you know, we can make this thing as long as we want. And in fact, some of our organic molecules are actually really complex, long polymers. So the thing to appreciate is that monomers or building blocks are single subunits, just like linking these baby toys together. And when you link them, what you create is a more complex polymer. So we can join them, you know, we can add on additional units and make this thing longer and longer. Or we can take this thing and tear it down. We can disassemble and break apart each piece, making individual units again. So that's kind of where we're headed with the understanding of these parts and pieces. Okay, so we've got monomers and polymers taken care of. Like we talked in class last Wednesday, we're always going to place our reactants in this class on what side?
The left
side, good. And our products we're going to place on the right. Good. So the arrow in this class is going to point toward the products, and in here we're always going to have it pointing toward the right side of your reaction. Okay. In chemistry, I can't promise you they'll be so nice. Chemistry will run that arrow in all sorts of directions, running it toward the left and in equilibrium. Let's talk about what you're looking at in this particular reaction. You'll notice on the left-hand side, you've got monomers A, B, and C that are all linked together. How do I know they're linked together? Covalent lines, good. Are these single, double, or
single?
Single, good. So that tells me that A, B, and C are linked together in a very small polymer. What happened to them on the product side? Yeah, they're apart now, right? So it's showing me A plus B plus C, all as individual units. There is no bond line holding those together, okay? And one thing to appreciate about organic molecules, which is where we're heading, most of them are held together by covalent bonds. So you're going to expect to see these types of single lines, double lines between those monomers. Okay. So kind of getting us in the right direction, at the very bottom of your page are two more terms I'd like to describe for you, endergonic and exergonic reactions. This has to do with whether or not you use energy to perform a chemical reaction. Let's tackle endergonic reactions first. You'll notice that this is a type of reaction that involves the use of energy to build a molecule that's more complex. Okay, so endergonic technically means we're going to use energy. And the goal here is to involve the use of energy in building a more complex molecule. We're building a polymer. So in normal life, we talk about building houses, you know, putting train cars together. This all requires a lot of work to put things together and assemble them properly. In your own body, building muscle, growing new cells, all of that requires energy. That's why we eat food, is to help our bodies build these new components. So building requires an input of energy. So what's more trouble? Straightening up your room or your home or making a mess? Yeah, definitely straightening up. I can make a mess in 5 minutes, right? So if you're thinking about cleaning up a space in your home, cleaning up and tidying is, of course, an energy-intensive process. It's endergonic in nature. If somebody says, okay, have at it, make a mess, it doesn't take us very long to destroy someplace and tear it down. Breaking down molecules or making a mess of our homes is actually an exergonic reaction, one that releases energy. So in our own bodies, breaking down body parts, such as worn out cell parts, breaking down muscle, even breaking down fat, releases energy. We knew that because if you break down fat, you lose weight. So breaking down molecules releases energy. It doesn't require energy to do the breakdown, but we actually produce more energy than is used in those reactions. Okay, so ender means coming into, exer means what? Going out, right? So use those two prefixes to help you remember whether or not we use energy or generate energy in those chemical reactions. How about questions on these two terms? Okay, why don't we... Oh, there's activation energy, but I tell you what, we're going to cover that with enzymes, and I think it will make better sense when we talk about enzymes. So I'll make a note that we'll hit activation energy in a couple of pages. Just checking to see if anybody needs a slide. About the chemical reactions that are found over on the top of page 18. At the very top of your page is a term that means all of our chemical reactions, and it's known as metabolism. Metabolism can be broken down into building reactions and breaking down reactions. You'll notice there on this page we have anabolism and we have catabolism. We've got the building and the breakdown reactions. Okay, so let's do an anabolic reaction. If we're going to take these individual subunits and link them together, we are doing what's called an anabolic reaction. We are synthesizing or making a more complex molecule. So the action of linking these together means that we are building a molecule. So there's a lot of language here that means the same thing. What we just did is called an anabolic reaction. We built a more complex polymer. It's also called a synthesis reaction, or more elaborately, a dehydration synthesis reaction. And it's in chemistry called a combination reaction. Any way you look at it, we just built a more complex polymer than what we started with. Okay? So building polymers is what we do in a synthesis or an anabolic reaction. If you have trouble keeping this straight, think about what anabolic steroids do to a person's muscles. For someone who takes anabolic steroids, the muscles bulk, right? Okay, so I think of anabolic as being a reminder that we're building or bulking up those molecules. All right, by contrast, let's talk about the other terminology there. Catabolic reactions are breakdown reactions. So if we take our little short polymer here and we break it up into its individual building blocks, we just broke this one down. Another name for the breakdown reaction is a hydrolysis reaction. And in chemistry, it's called a decomposition reaction. So a lot of names for the ultimately the same process that we're looking at. Okay, so what I'd like to do is talk you through anabolic reactions a little more closely. Anabolic reactions take at least two monomers, join them together, and the product is what?
Polymer
in a water. Good. So anabolic reactions join monomers to make polymers. One of those products is also going to be a water molecule. Reactions, we're going to come back to those in just a minute. Let's focus on those anabolic reactions right now. I want you to look for a pattern, and the pattern is this. On the reactant side, we're dealing with monomers or building blocks. Sometimes they don't scream at you, I am a monomer. You kind of have to look at the whole picture to realize that you've got a building reaction. What you can do, though, is look on the product side and look to see if you have polymers over there, and what else should you see as part of the products?
Water.
That's right.
With every anabolic.
That's right.
With every anabolic reaction, there's going to be water.
It's going to be water.
Okay.
Yep.
So there's no separation between that and the aggregate.
Not in this class. Okay. We're gonna talk about them all as kind of the same process in here. Yeah. Okay. So. When you look at something like A and B and C joining together, we're going to look at that as being a building reaction. These are all individual monomer pieces. You'll notice over here on the product side, what has happened to all three of those monomers? They're single bonded, right? And what does that tell us about those three? It's a polymer, good. And then water happens to be shown here as a product, so that's another clue that we're looking for. When we talk about how organic molecules are treated in our body, we know that organic molecules follow the same pattern when they're being built. Now, there's another name for this reaction when we talk specifically about the removal of water from the monomers and why it shows up over here as a polymer, or rather as a product. The whole process here is known as a dehydration, synthesis reaction. And let's think about what those terms mean. When you dehydrate something, what are you doing to it? Removing the water. You're removing the water from these monomers over here on the reactant side, and you have to show that you removed it by listing it as a product on the other side of the reaction. So that's why it's considered a dehydration issue. And then what does synthesize mean?
To make.
Yes, so we're making a polymer there in the process of removing water from these monomers. So that's what we're going to look for as a general pattern by which we remove water from the monomers and we show it over here as a product with the polymer. All right, so understanding that, this is an actual example of a dehydration synthesis reaction. This is a building reaction. that we take monomers of glucose and fructose, and we make sucrose, which we understand to be a polymer, and then there's our water molecule. So we haven't talked about these sugars yet, but we're going to understand in a few minutes about how these follow the general rule. Okay, so one of the best things to look for is look for your water. That confirms for us that we have a dehydration synthesis or a building reaction. Let me caution you to be quick on a test. You know, sometimes we look for something, we say, oh yeah, that's what it is, and you know, we fail to process the whole picture. Okay, so this is the trap to avoid, right? Acids and bases yield salt and water. Is this a dehydration synthesis reaction? It is not. It's what? Neutralization, yes. So don't follow the trap of saying, oh, there's water, and neglect what else is happening here, because, of course, this is a neutralization reaction. Even though it looks like it follows the same pattern, it's really not. So we'll kind of make this one a little separate thing down here. Talk about catabolic reactions for a moment. Catabolic technically means to break down. What are we breaking down? Oh, polymers into monomers. Good. And we're going to talk specifically about how organic molecules break down polymers into monomers. And we're going to use hydrolysis to kind of work our way through this. So this time you'll notice that water is showing here as one of our reactants. It helps us to break apart the bonds and create the individual monomers. So compare the two reactions for me, the anabolic to the catabolic reaction. What do you see?
They're opposite.
They're opposite. Good. So they are exact opposite to each other. And like I said, we're dealing here with organic molecules, and we're using water in our bodies to make these reactions take place, especially that catabolic reaction. So we do follow the same general pattern, it's just an opposite. We flip-flopped our reactants and our products when we talk about these breakdown reactions. The more specific type that we're working with here in organic molecules is called hydrolysis. All right, so help me break down the word hydrolysis. What is hydro?
Water.
Good. And lysis?
Breaking down.
Breaking down, split. Good. So what water is doing, it's playing a role of a jackhammer. It literally breaks these bonds between our polymers and allows us to separate them into individual pieces or monomers. So that's why we are encouraged to drink so much water every day. You've got to have that water to help break those polymers down into monomers. So if you're aiming to lose weight, don't skimp on the water, okay? Because the water is what's going to help you break apart those polymers of fat molecules and break them into building blocks. Okay. So if you take this particular chemical reaction that we used as an example, how would you rewrite this one to give us a breakdown reaction?
Sucrose plus water breaks down into glucose and fructose.
Good, yeah, just flip-flop those two, reactants and products, good. All right. So, yeah, this time we're looking again for water to show up as a reactant. That's a great clue that we're dealing with a breakdown reaction. No more specifically in our organic compound discussion as a hydrolysis reaction. Okay. So, why don't we talk about some specific examples? Let me give you a list here to look at. Okay, and so, let me give you a moment to read through the list. If you want to compare with a seatmate next to you, feel free. And then in just a moment, we're going to get together and see if we can decide which ones of these are building or breakdown reactions.
Okay.
When I was born the flu, it had an exam question where it had it showed an image of like hydrogen double bonded to hydrogen double bonded to another carbon and then double bonded to hydrogen. And it asked what type of bond hold the carbon and the hydrogen together. So the option was like double bond, covalent bond, and some other improvements.
Okay.
But I put double because it clearly showed a double. But it said like it was covalent. So why would it be one and not the other?
I'm thinking that it probably shows single lines between the carbons and the hydrogens because hydrogen only has one electron to share. So it would not actually be able to, it's impossible for it to perform a double bond. So I'm thinking that's probably what that chemical compound showed was a single bond between carbon and hydrogen. One line.
It showed, it didn't even show one line. It showed like two molecules.
Did it have electrons in the orbitals?
Yeah, like one circle with two electrons right there, and then the other circle with two electrons.
Two electrons is a pair, so that's why it would be a single bond and not a double bond.
Okay.
If it was four lined out together between one atom and the neighboring atom, then you'd have a double bond.
Okay.
That's a good question. Y'all have answers? Think so? I know we've all probably had something dirty, like on an egg stuck on a plate that you can't wash off, and you leave it soaking in a sink full of water. Come back the next morning, your plate's clean, right? So are you building or breaking down?
Breaking down.
Breaking down, good. So kind of shows you how water acts as a, you know, reactant there to help break apart those polymers. Okay. The next example of baking a cake, what do you think?
Building.
Yeah, it's an anabolic reaction. Yeah. So, of course, you mix ingredients, you bake it. When you pull that cake out of the oven, you're probably hit in the face with some hot steam. That's the water that was removed through dehydration synthesis, you know, if we're thinking about it in terms of how organic molecules were to work. The next example there, glucose and fructose, is one we used on the board. Notice that water is a product. This one is?
Anabolic.
That it's a building reaction. The next one's a great example, digesting food.
Catabolic.
Good. And like I said, they always recommend you to drink so many ounces of water per day, and it is to help break apart those food molecules, polymers, into their building blocks or monomers. And then growing new skin, what does that sound like?
Anabolic,
right? Building, good. So growing new skin requires those monomers to join to make polymers. How'd you do with these, Liz? Do you have any questions on the two types of reactions?
Well, questions like that, the
there may be one or two, yeah. And often we'll give like this one as an example on the test. Okay, so looks like we're ready to start with the organic compounds. They're over on page 19. All right, so a lot of people find this material to be very dry. It's not something that's terribly interesting. And if you find that when you're home studying this stuff and it's not sticking, maybe try some flashcards to get this material to stick. So when we talk through the organic compound groups, you'll notice on the top of page 19, there's a building block, there's a function, and there basically the rest of the page is types or examples. So those are the three primary things you need to know. You need to know the building block or monomer, what the function is, and then any examples that we go over. So those may be some things you want to flashcard if you're having trouble getting this to stick.
what do all of our organic compounds share? Well, they're almost all built from long chains of carbons and hydrogens. Quite often we find oxygen in there as well. We often find nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. It depends on what kind of molecules, but we do find those as well. Okay, these are most often produced by living organisms, although that's not a requirement. A lot of times these molecules assemble on their own in nature. And they're often held together by covalent bonds. In fact, all the ones we talk about are going to be covalently bonded together. Last term there, macromolecules. What does that mean?
Large.
Yeah, a lot of them are really large. I'm just checking to see if anybody still needs a slide. Okay. Anybody else still need this one? Yeah, good to go. Okay. So to kind of wrap this into what we were just discussing, we just talked about breakdown reactions and building reactions. The whole goal of talking about organic molecules is to understand how our bodies work. So the foods that we eat are broken down through catabolic or hydrolysis reactions, and those molecules are then taken and reassembled into parts. So, for instance, we may take the fat and store it in our own fat. We may, in fact, take the protein and build our own proteins, and the carbs we'll take and turn into energy. So we do take these products and reuse them for other purposes once in our bodies. So the whole purpose of Bio-210 and especially 211 is to kind of explore what we do with all these components and how we make these components work. If you've ever looked at a food label, you may have noticed there's a lot of information on there. We're going to talk about a lot of this stuff today. Fat, cholesterol, we're not going to talk about the sodium. We're going to talk about fibers and sugars under the carbs and proteins. If you know anything about those organic molecules, you'll notice there's one category missing. Which one?
The nucleic acids.
Yeah, no nucleic acids.
Nucleic acids.
So we don't necessarily look to food groups to maintain our nucleic acid health, but maybe we should put that on food labels. Because those nucleic acids that we eat in animal and plant sources help us build our ATP, our own DNA and RNA molecules. But I think people would be grossed out if they thought about it that way, and we'll kind of consider why in just a little bit. So our first major group here is called the carbohydrates, and this particular group is built from carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens. If you break the word down, carbohydrate, you see carbon as the first portion of the word. Hydrate is water. Okay, and so hydrogen and oxygen are two components of a water molecule. These carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens arrange themselves into simple sugars known as monosaccharides. They are the building blocks for our sugars. So what does monosaccharide imply? One simple sugar, one single molecule. The simplest types of carbs give you quick energy. Now, the more complex the carb, the longer the burn of energy that you're going to get. In fact, if you take a look at our examples list, mono, di, and polysaccharides, the further you get down the list, the longer the energy burn you're going to get from that molecule. So if you want a really quick burst of energy, pick the first one, the monosaccharide, or even the second one, the disaccharide. But if you want to have a carb that lasts you, say, several hours, pick the poly, which is a more complex carb. I think of carbs like I think of wood on a fire. If you want a fire that burns hot and fast and is over in about 20 minutes, put yourself a bunch of little teeny tiny monosaccharides, little dry twigs on that fire, okay? Now, if you want a fire that's going to be steady, maintain heat for several hours, pick those big logs of polysaccharides. They give you a much longer burn of energy, okay? So our typical carbohydrate is built from a very simple monosaccharide. Many of ours are built from glucose molecules. And I know this looks a little funky compared to what we've been seeing, but let's look for what's familiar in this monosaccharide. What do these C's represent?
Carbon.
Carbons, good. And the H's?
Hydrogen.
And the O's?
Oxygen.
Okay. And the single lines?
Single.
Good. They are covalent bonds. They are single in nature. How many pairs of electrons are being shared?
One.
One pair, right. So over here, there's a lone double bond between that carbon and oxygen, but otherwise, the whole thing is held together by single covalent bonds. Now, when we talk about organic chemistry, oftentimes these molecules like to arrange themselves in a ring fashion, and that's what has happened here. Instead of being straight in a line, like you see on the left, this molecule has just kind of snaked itself around into a ring-like shape, okay? It's still the same thing, it just happens to be an organic structure, so it coils itself up. All right, so let's take a look here. They have very nicely numbered the carbons for us. How many carbons are in a glucose molecule? There are six there. Okay, so the general rule of thumb for a The general rule of thumb for a carbon or carbohydrate is to follow this rule. Okay, this is the baseline rule for carbs. This particular glucose has six carbon atoms. That means I should have twice the number of hydrogens. So in fact, I do. 12, good. And how many oxygens?
Six.
You got it. Good. Does glucose with this formula of C6H12O6 follow the rule?
Yeah.
It follows the rule. There's twice the hydrogens as there are carbons and oxygens. Okay? So almost every carb follows this general formula of having about twice the hydrogens as carbons and oxygens. Something else about glucose, it's considered a monosaccharide because it has between 3 and 7 carbons. Does it fit that rule?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it fits that rule. Good. So it's got between 3 and 7 carbon atoms. It follows the rule of being a monosaccharide. This, by the way, is your body's preferred fuel. What do we use glucose to make? ATP. Yeah, this is our preferred way of making ATP. Well, glucose has a couple of friends. They have almost the same identical structure, but if you look, they're a little different. The formula happens to be the same. So both glucose and its buddy, galactose, have the same formula, C6H12O6. But if you look closely, almost everything matches up, but on the left side, you'll notice the hydrogen and oxygen arrangement there is flip-flopped. That's the only difference between glucose and galactose. Since these are very similar in terms of their formula and their structure is the only thing that differs, we're going to call these two isomers of each other. Okay, so isomers and isotopes, now we've got two terms rolling with this iso prefix. Okay, so these are called isomers. They have the same formula, different structure. Good, they got the same formula, different structure. Same formula, different structure. You know what? Glucose, galactose, and fructose are all isomers of each other. They all have the C6H12O6 formula, They have just slightly different structures. Do you think your body can tell the difference? It can, yeah. Your body says, I really want the glucose molecule. I'll take the other two and modify them to kind of make them look like glucose. But, you know, it's really happiest when you give it glucose. So when we think about all these food products on the market that contain high fructose corn syrup, the corn industry says, hey, it's sugar. And in a way, they're kind of right. In what way are they right?
Same formula.
Yeah, so in that way, they've got the argument down pat. But how are they wrong about the argument?
The structure's
different, yeah. And so what we're discovering is your body knows the difference. Your body prefers the glucose. It doesn't really want the fructose. It's not as sweet as the glucose is. And so you don't feel satisfied when you've had something with high fructose corn syrup, or not as satisfied as if you've had it with the glucose in there. So when you're not satisfied with what you've eaten, your body wants more. Exactly. So your brain says, give me some of that glucose, and so you go in search of something sweet. So that's kind of what we think is happening with that high fructose corn syrup. It's not really giving us what our brains want. There's a satisfaction center in your brain that says, ding, 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 that was yummy, that was great, I'm good to go. And of course, fructose doesn't hit that satisfaction center in your brain. Okay, so isomers have the same what? That's it, same formula, different structure. Okay. All right, so when we take monomers like glucose and we join them together, we're performing what type of reaction?
Anabolic.
Good. So we're building a more complex polymer. You'll notice that two glucose molecules, with the removal of water between them, can create a more complex disaccharide molecule. It's known as maltose. So you probably noticed the trend here that all these that we've dealt with so far have an O-S-E ending. What does that mean to us?
Sugar.
I'm a sugar. Yeah, if you have an O-S-E ending, you're getting the trend, I'm a sugar. Glucose and fructose can join. This is back to our example once again. When they join together and remove water, they're going to create a more complex disaccharide known as sucrose. Where have you heard of sucrose before? Yeah, this plain old table sugar, right? So we show water down here as a product. That's because this reaction is anabolic, right? It's the building reaction. Good. So this, of course, is the way that sugars are built, not the way our bodies do it necessarily. We're not building table sugar. We build other kinds of complex molecules this way. Finally, in the polysaccharides, we have three major examples there: glycogen, starch, and cellulose. You'll notice that glycogen is an animal polysaccharide. And notice that starch and cellulose are plant polysaccharides. Right, so a lot of six-sided rings here. It looks like little tiny green beads all hooked together. Every one of these is a glucose molecule. So you think, wow, that's a lot of glucose molecules hooked together. That must store a lot of energy, and yeah, it does. Glycogen is how us animals store our glucose in our livers and in our muscles. The catch is we only store the glycogen for around 3 days. If you're still storing the glycogen after about 3 days, guess what your body says we should do with it? Store as fat. Yeah, so take that glycogen, turn it into fat, and now you have a bigger problem, right? Because you've got to break down the fat back into the glycogen before you can burn it off as glucose. So that's why if you have, you know, a bad day where you think, I'm just going to eat junk food all day, I just, you know, I don't care anymore. And so you have a bunch of junk food one day and you feel like, oh man, I messed up, I'm going to gain a ton of weight from all this junk food. You've got 3 days to burn it off. So if you go hit a buffet, if you eat a bunch of candy and a bunch of junk food one day, 3 days to burn that glycogen off before it becomes fat. So after 3 days, now you've got that additional transformation process into fatty molecules. So when you eat animals, animal meats, you know, whether it's beef or chicken, or if you eat cheeses, some of those have fats in there, but sometimes when you're thinking about animal meat, there is some stored glycogen in there as well. So there's two different things that we're thinking of that store energy. I want to make the point that glycogen is not fat. Glycogen is simply a polysaccharide. It's a more complex form of glucose. In fact, it's glucose is all linked together. The next step after glycogen is to transform this, though, into a fatty molecule, which is, of course, not a sugar. All right. Starch and glycogen are similar. They're both storages of glucose in the body, but of course, starches are found in plant bodies, not animal bodies. So what are some great sources of plant starches?
Potatoes.
Potatoes and breads. Rice. Pasta, yeah. Okay, so what they call the white foods, you know, potatoes, rice, you know, breads. Yeah, all that stuff is power-packed with starches, and starches contain glucose molecules. So when kids hit, you know, college for the first time, 18, 20 years old, a lot of times kids move away, they live in a dorm, and of course they eat that food in the cafeteria, which is all the white food. It's pastas, rice, potatoes, and it's comforting because it makes you feel satiated and full. But the bad side is, what happens if you don't burn off all these glucose molecules? Stores as fat, yeah. So they have a freshman 15 or maybe the freshman 50. Gain you some weight that you never lose. You get more than you bargained for, right? So yeah, eating starchy products that you don't burn off are going to stay with you. All right, and then the final type of polysaccharide is this one called cellulose. Do you have the enzymes to digest and break it down?
No.
Nope. So cellulose is one that we cannot digest. It is fiber that passes through your body undigested. What is the benefit of eating fiber-rich foods?
Keeps you regular.
Yeah, it keeps you regular. And another thing about fiber, these molecules hang on to water, and so when you eat a fibrous food, you feel bloated, which I don't know if it's good or not to feel bloated, but nonetheless, that bloating makes you feel full, so you're likely to eat less food. That means less calories. So they say there's a benefit to eating fibrous foods for the bloat that it gives you. It gives you a full feeling after having eaten it. So, you know, if you fill up on a salad, which, you know, oh so tasty, right, that lettuce will bloat you because of all the water in those lettuce leaves, and then, of course, the cellulose will make you have a bowel movement. All right. On this page, those examples, glucose, fructose, galactose as monosaccharides, maltose and sucrose, you'll want to know those as disaccharides, and then we just covered glycogen, starch, and cellulose as polys. You'll want to know those examples. If you have a hard time getting them to stick, I think flashcards can help those stick between now and the test.
Yeah. Does that apply for all sugars or just the monosaccharides?
It pretty much applies for all of them. And there may be a little different, like one or two off, but for the most part, they're going to follow that same general, twice the hydrogen rule.
I saw one earlier that was like 12 and then
22 hydrogen. Yeah. Yeah, that, I can't work slide that one on, but that's close enough, so they'll say that, yeah, that fits the rule. Would y'all like to take about a 5-minute break, stretch your legs? Why don't we come back about 9:10, and then we'll keep on working with this stuff. Okay, let me get you back into page 20. So here's your same general routine. For each group, you know, look for the monomer or building block, look for the function, and then specific types. That's what we're going to do again here with the fat or lipid category. The fats actually are a little different because they have two building blocks. Most of them have a fatty acid number of chains, and then most of them have some number of glycerol heads. Okay, so building blocks here are a little different. Fatty acid chains and glycerol heads compose our lipids, most of them at least. I think we probably get the idea that fats store energy, but they're actually more varied than that. Some of them perform functions as hormones in our bodies. They do build the structures of our cell membranes, so there are other very important functions for those lipids besides simply just storing fat as triglycerides. There's a set of examples here that we're going to work through. Go into all those details and examples, what I'd like to do is explain that the fatty acid chain that composes most of our lipids can be classified as saturated or unsaturated. So I'd like to spend some time first talking about those fatty acid chains. They're on the bottom of your page. There's two pictures for us to look at. I'm just checking to see if anybody still needs this slide. Yeah, good. Okay. All right, so hey, same routine, right? Lots of carbons, lots of hydrogens, not so many oxygens here, but still, it fits the bill for being an organic molecule. We're going to leave alone that glycerol head for just a moment. We're going to focus on that fatty acid chain. These fatty acid chains are linked together with those glycerol heads, and that's what makes our typical fatty molecule. Just wanted to make a note here that the head is considered to be a polar region of your whole entire fat. By being polar, what does that mean?
Likes water.
Likes water, yes. So it shares unequally among its components or members there. And yeah, you're exactly right, it likes water. In terms of that fatty acid chain, you'll notice it says it hates water, it's hydrophobic. That's a good term for us to start using because it's going to relate to how cell membranes work. So the head is hydrophilic, it loves water because it's polar. The tail, or the fatty acid chain, is hydrophobic, it hates water. So of course it's nonpolar.
Fats too, right?
Like yeah.
You can use the word interchangeably.
I would use them interchangeably.
Sure.
Anybody still need this slide?
I have a question.
Sure.
In our booklet, the saturated fat is the chain you have for the fatty or the unsaturated.
The fatty.
Is the unsaturated?
This one's saturated.
Oh, okay. I'm wrong. Okay.
That's
yep.
Probably okay. So the glycerol head is I guess I'd say the boring part, it's not going to be different from one fat to the next. The glycerol head is just a region of the fat that is linked to the fatty acid chain. Let's talk about the chain, the fatty acid portion, because that's the exciting part of our fats. In the top picture, I want you to notice that we're going to ignore the stuff over here in red, that piece right there, and we're going to ignore it down here as well. Okay? What we're going to focus on are these carbons and hydrogens that are all linked together. Let's talk about carbon for just a moment. So carbon has 6 as its atomic number. That means 6 protons and what else?
6 electrons.
6 electrons, good. So if we just do a simple carbon atom, six protons, six neutrons, six electrons, we're going to place two of those electrons in the innermost orbital. How many electrons are placed on the next orbital?
Four.
Good. All right. Stable or reactive?
Reactive.
Yeah, it's reactive. It actually has room for four more electrons, so it's going to be one that's going to encourage reactivity among other atoms. In fact, let me just draw this over here. There's our carbon atom. It's willing to form bonds with four other atoms. And what we see here in the fatty acid chain, those happen to be other hydrogens or even other carbon atoms. So that's what we've done there to help stabilize the valence shell of our carbons. So in the saturated form, we have every possible binding site filled up with either a carbon or another hydrogen. You'll notice the chain here is straight. It does not bend or kink, and it's full, which is why we call it a saturated fatty acid chain. When these fatty acid chains are at room temperature, they pack really tight, one on top of another, just like laying dishes or sheets down. They're going to stack really tight where there's no room for air molecules in between. I make that point because at room temperature, are these saturated fats solids or liquids?
Solids.
Good. So what are some examples?
Butter.
Butter, yeah.
Grease,
lard. Yeah. So the stuff that often tastes better is saturated, but it is far worse for us because it's packed full of atoms that we have building the backbone of this fatty acid chain. So saturated fats are actually the least healthy, but they do pack the most energy storage in terms of that chain. All right, so let's compare that to the unsaturated fats. What do you notice about this fatty acid chain?
It has a double bond instead where the hydrogen could be.
Good. You've got a kinked up chain. I heard somebody say it's not straight. You've got a double bond, okay? And of course, there are missing hydrogens. There's two missing hydrogens there. So let's go back to our carbon atom. We know that it needs four more electrons to stabilize its valence shell. If your carbon doesn't have hydrogens, it turns to the neighbor for a double bond. If you think about it, there's one, two bonds right there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a third one, and there's your fourth one. So, ha, sneaky carbon, it still got its four bonds in. It did this by doing a double bond with the neighboring carbon atom. So every time you have a double bond, it's really strong. In fact, it's so strong that it kinks up this fatty acid chain. So in room temperature situations, there's an air pocket trapped right about there. So this makes the molecules liquid at room temperature, not solid. What are some examples that fall into this category?
Oils,
good. So all the oils, vegetable, canola, cottonseed, all those oils that are liquid at room temperature have kinked up fatty acid chains because they're missing what?
Hydrogens.
Yeah, they're missing hydrogens. Good.
So is that why it's better for you to connect with
that may taste better in terms of a saturated fat, but you're right, in terms of health, there's less hydrogens bonded to the chain. Ultimately, that's less for us to break down. So that's, yeah, much better choice. Let's see, on your sheet you've got monounsaturated and polyunsaturated. I'd like to show you the difference between these two. Okay, so from the left, you have a straight fatty acid chain. How would you classify it?
Saturated.
Yeah, every single carbon has hydrogens bonded to it, so it's going to be a straight chain. In terms of healthiness, that's actually your worst one. The one sitting next to it, though, has a double bond right there, and it's caused that chain to kink and bend on us. So this one has only one double bond, therefore it's monounsaturated, meaning it's got only a single double bond in there. Okay. Now, look at linolenic. This is our far right example. Look at all the kinks and bends here. There's lots of double bonds. What does that mean about the numbers of hydrogens stored? There's less, yeah. So on your worksheet, it says that polyunsaturated fats have many double bonds, Okay, so polyunsaturated fats, that's about dead center of page 20. Polyunsaturated fats have many double bonds, and they're the best choice in terms of health. So why do you say a polyunsaturated is the healthiest choice?
Less to break down.
Less to break down, exactly. So there's less hydrogens there. Ultimately, that means less for us to break down. You know what? In the past, that has been an essay question. Okay, so looking at these three choices here, you would rank them from worst to best. Which would be your worst choice to eat? Yeah, the first one, steric. The best choice?
The last one.
Last one, linolenic, yeah. Why is the saturated fat the worst choice? There's more to break down. Every carbon has hydrogens linked up to it, as opposed to the linolenic, which is missing
hydrogens.
Yeah, so the less you store on that fatty acid chain, the less you ultimately have to break down. Okay. Oh, don't worry about these here. These
okay.
are just examples. But I would do mono versus polyunsaturated versus saturated. All right, so I think that hits page 20. Do y'all have any questions there? Mm-hmm. On page 21, let's talk about the other way we think of fats, and that is by the number of chains that they house. So in this picture, you're looking at a glycerol head over here on the left-hand side. Right there it is. And this is the long fatty acid chain. By the way, is this fatty acid chain saturated or unsaturated?
Saturated.
Good, it is saturated. You'll notice there are no what?
Breaks.
Yeah, no double bonds. Yeah, so no kinks, no bends there. Every carbon has been saturated with the max number of hydrogens. Now, this particular setup is one head and one fatty acid chain. This is called a monoglyceride. Okay, and on your worksheet there it says it's one glycerol plus one fatty acid chain. So if you read a food label and you actually read the ingredient list and you see monoglycerides, well, you at least know that there's only one fatty acid chain, even though it may be a saturated chain. But one chain is definitely better than two fatty acid chains. You've now doubled the number of chains there. So this one is a diglyceride. How many fatty acid chains?
Two.
There's two. And ooh, they're both saturated. Three, yeah, triglycerides have three fatty acid chains, and oh boy, in this picture, they're all saturated. So if you read food labels and you see monoglycerides and diglycerides, and not too terribly bad, but a triglyceride like this one here is gonna power pack a bunch of energy storage. In fact, in the human body, this is what stores fat in our molecules, like our adipocytes, loose adipose connective tissue, right? So these adipocytes store triglycerides, and the triglycerides are floating through your bloodstream on their way to their destination, which is some adipocyte somewhere. If they do a blood test and they find a lot of triglycerides, they say we're at a higher risk for heart disease because these triglycerides can cause damage inside of our vessels. So yeah, triglycerides for us are the way that we store our excess energy.
It's not like a gym where you can burn off
everything. Unfortunately, yeah, a little harder to burn off. So if you get 100 calories from, say, a protein versus 100 calories from one of these, then yeah, you've got something that stores a lot more energy in there, ultimately more difficult to break down. Okay. About midway down your page, you'll notice there are phospholipids. Why are these important?
Because they line the cell membrane.
Good. They're the cell membrane structure. There's two layers of them. And you'll notice that they have one glycerol head and two fatty acid chains. Technically, they're diglycerides, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of their fatty acid chains is straight, meaning it's saturated. What about the other one?
The kink is unsaturated.
It's unsaturated, good. It's kinked. And it only has a, it's hard to say this for it doesn't sound confusing, it has a single double bond, right? It has only one double bond. So is it monounsaturated or polyunsaturated?
Monounsaturated.
Mono, yes. Yeah. So right there is where we see that double bond. It has kinked that chain. So these are certainly important. They do form the phospholipid bilayer of our cell membranes, something that we're going to talk about as soon as we start into chapter 3. I'm not going to cover these. Just wanted to mention that they're out there. You can look at them in your worksheet. They're a type of eicosanoids. What a word that is. Leukotrienes can cause inflammation. They're part of the inflammatory process. And then, of course, prostaglandins are localized hormones. If you have itchy, watery eyes and sneezing during allergy season, thank you to the leukotrienes for that. And if you're a female with menstrual cramps, you can thank your prostaglandins for that. Okay, so they're localized hormones. Don't worry about those. They're not going to be on test one, nor will they be on the final exam. So you can just put an X through those if you like. Woohoo, you can mark something out. See, I could take them out of the course pack, and then we could just skip them all together, but it feels good to mark something out, all right? Okay, last fat is arguably different from every other fat. The steroids, some textbooks argue, should not even be in this category. They should be their own by themselves. So they don't fit the rules, right?
No.
Okay, so do you see a glycerol head here?
They
don't have a head, they don't have the tails, the fatty acid chains. They are made instead of four carbon rings all fused together. So totally different setup. The cholesterol molecules that are in your body are basically the steroid examples that build for us things like estrogen and testosterone and other hormones like aldosterone. So steroids are different. They're four fused rings of carbon. And some say they really shouldn't be lipids at all because they don't match up with the fatty acid chains and glycerol head. Oops. So there's cholesterol. Gets a bad reputation. It is important for building our cell membranes. And it's also important for building your sex hormones like estrogens in females and testosterone in males. Okay. Any questions on those fats or carbs? Brain's starting to fill up yet. This is so much just chemistry information. We've got two more groups left, and then we'll be done with this chapter. The proteins are next, and you'll notice their building blocks or monomers are called the amino acids. There's 20 amino acids on Earth. They build up all of our proteins, everything from our hair and skin and fingernails to the scaly skin on snakes, and the proteins that are found in plants all come from the same combinations or similar combinations of those amino acids. Proteins we know are important for providing structures in our bodies. Some proteins then are called structural proteins. Other proteins have a job to do, and because they're serving some type of function, they're called functional proteins. So let me give you an example. Fingernails have proteins in them. Fingernails are for defense because without them you have no way to, you know, have claws, so to speak. So would you classify them as structural or functional?
Functional.
They're functional. Yeah, so fingernails are functional. Hormones, for instance, are functional. Enzymes are functional. Some of the plasma membrane proteins are structural. They're building a structure, okay? And then we've got hair, nails, muscle. These can also be classified as functional. They're serving some function, whether it's protection, or movement in terms of muscles. All right. I do want to mention here these peptide bonds, which are specialized bonds that hold together amino acids. They're more than just covalent bonds. The box here in purple illustrates what's involved in making a peptide bond. You'll notice it's actually all four top elements, right? Carbons, hydrogens, oxygen, and nitrogen make up a peptide bond. And on either side here, you've got an amino acid that's being linked by that specialized peptide bond. So when you hear the word peptide, what should you think of?
Proteins,
yeah. So peptide bonds make proteins by linking what together?
Amino acids.
Amino acids, good. If you know the routine, then this one follows the pattern. Mono is one. Di is how many?
Two.
And poly?
Many.
Good. This one's a dipeptide. Okay, it's got two amino acids. One here on the left. There's your peptide bond. There's your amino acid on the right. So it's a very small protein. Most of our proteins are more complex than that. Most fall into the situation of having many amino acids linked together, like you see here. Some can even have hundreds or thousands of amino acids, and we would definitely classify those big proteins as polypeptides. So in terms of protein structure at the bottom of your page, there's four levels of twisting that these proteins go through. What you're looking at here simply is a linear structure. We say it's beads on a string, and it's a primary structure of a protein. So if you think about pearls or beads on a string, that's a primary structure.
What was that other thing that you said?
Pearls or beads on a string is a linear primary structure.
And then you said something else.
Was it about the protein structure? Polypeptide maybe?
No, maybe you didn't. I'll go back and look.
Okay. It's recorded, so we can always listen to that. Proteins don't usually stop here with their structure. This is just the starting line in terms of how proteins are made. When proteins are linked together through anabolic reactions, they're going to get in line in a particular order. So you've got all these amino acids starting to line up like beads on a string. At the very top, there's your primary structure. It looks like pearls or beads on a string in that very top picture. And then we follow suit to a secondary level of structure right here. Ooh, I want to sneeze. No, maybe not. Okay. So the secondary level of structure has two forms, an alpha helix or a beta pleated sheath. The alpha helix looks like a curl or a coil over here on the right. Or your protein may take on this beta pleated sheet, which is literally like taking a piece of paper and folding it up accordion style. Okay, so beta pleated sheet or alpha helix, those are the two options that a protein takes for its secondary level of structure.
Are you saying DTA beta?
Beta, that's exactly right, like a beta fish. I don't know about you, but this third level doesn't look like much but a pile of ribbon. But to the protein, that means everything. The protein's function drives its shape. So this particular shape here doesn't mean a lot to me, but to the protein, it's very important. So the third level, you involve beta pleated sheets, you involve these alpha curls, these alpha helices, and this particular shape here is going to be driven by its function. And if you take multiple polypeptides and you put them all together, like down here, you actually get a quaternary level of structure. So it's not just one polypeptide chain, it's multiples acting as a unit. They've color-coded them for us so that we can see that there's different polypeptides there. Now, in reality, you may say, okay, how does this work? Here you go. You've got collagen on the left and hemoglobin on the right. These are important proteins in our bodies. Do you know what collagen does? It's in what kind of tissues? Connective, yeah. That's a connective tissue protein, very important one. And hemoglobin, why is it important? Blood, yeah, that's your blood protein. That transports oxygen. So to us, that doesn't look like a whole lot, but it's very important for the structure and how that protein is driven, how it's going to be doing its job. Okay. Do you have any questions so far on the proteins? Okay. Page 23 is going to be a little more on proteins, but very specifically on your enzymes. Enzymes do a job. Are they structural or functional proteins?
Functional.
They're functional. Good. Enzymes help us out with metabolism. We just talked about metabolism. It's the sum of all of what?
Reactions,
good. And so either you're building or you're breaking down, and enzymes come along and say, hey, I can help out. I can make your whole reaction run faster. Who wouldn't want that, right? Makes your reactions run faster, more efficiently. So you'll notice in this picture that enzymes are built very specifically for the substrate that they work on. In fact, they have what's called a lock and key fit between the enzyme and its substrate. You'll notice where they fit together. It's called an active site, and they have to more or less fit for them to work on each other. So that means that enzymes that are built for specific substrates just can't go and do anything. So I have this mental image of having a key and walking through a neighborhood. You can try it in every door, but it's only going to work in your door, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's how enzymes work. They're only going to work in locks that they really fit with. They're not going to work on any other door lock. So that means that they're very specific to the jobs that they must do. Let's see. Near the top of your page, there's an indented bullet point, one of those hollow ones that says enzymes often have an ending of what?
A-S-E.
Good. So now you've got another little shortcut piece of information. Maltase is an enzyme. And if it's working on a sugar, the sugar is going to have an ending of what?
O-S-E.
Yes, so maltase works on maltose. What would sucrase work on?
Sucrose,
good. A couple pages ago I mentioned that we don't have the enzyme to break down cellulose. Therefore, we don't have
cellulase.
Yeah, we don't have cellulase. So, you know, we're not like cows that can break down grasses and other kinds of sugars in plants. We don't have that particular enzyme. Okay, so we've talked about the active site. Let's talk about activation energy. So what kinds of reactions require an input of energy?
Endergonic,
good. And so endergonic reactions require inputs of energy that are so large sometimes that can make your body temperature heat up. So having your body temperature heat up means that we're going to yo-yo your body temp, not necessarily a good thing. So enzymes say, hey, I'll help you out. I'll make sure that you can do this reaction without so much work. Let me lower the amount of energy that makes this reaction run. So enzymes come along and they chop down the heel of activation energy. In this picture, notice the red peak up there. It says without enzymes. If you're taking a ball, 400-pound lead ball, and your job is to push it over that heel all by yourself, you're going to huff and puff and work it really hard to get that ball up and over that heel. And so you're going to break a sweat, your body temperature is going to increase, and it's going to burn off a lot of your ATP just to do this reaction. What if the enzyme comes along and says, I can help you out, I will cut your heel in half. And not only that, I'll help you get it up and over. So it sounds like a great situation, right? So enzymes lower the amount of work that you have to do to make your chemical reactions run, especially those endergonic reactions that require an input of energy. So back when we talked about, you know, endergonic and exergonic reactions, where enzymes really pay off for us is they help us lower the amount of energy to get those endergonic reactions running. Okay, so I imagine them as like little shovels. They shovel that hill down and say, hey, I'll help you cut the energy down, and I'll help you push it up and over that hill. Does that make sense about activation energy? Can I explain it a different way for you, or does that make pretty good sense?
It helps lower the amount of energy needed.
Yes.
And what's the other thing?
They assist with the chemical reaction by speeding it up. Okay, and for that reason, they are called catalysts, because a catalyst is something that helps to speed up a chemical reaction. Okay, so not only do they lower the energy required to make the reaction run, they also speed up the rate of the chemical reaction. Therefore, they're called catalysts. So the middle of the page is a term there called denaturation. I'd like to talk to you about that term for just a moment. You'll notice that it says there it's when the shape of the enzyme is no longer at its proper shape, and that means the active site can no longer fit with the substrate. So if you change the shape of your enzyme where you can no longer fit with your substrate, what good is it, right? Okay, so what are some things that can denature your enzyme shape? Temperature?
Acids,
right. Is the temperature issue hot or cold? It's the heat, the hot, right. Okay, so you ever been sick, like really, really sick? You ever had a really high temperature? And I know that somebody in your family probably got really concerned if your temperature was pushing like 103, 104, 105. And we're always concerned about high fever, right? But what we don't realize is the reason we're concerned about the high fever is because of these things. If you have a high fever, like 104, 105 for several days on end, what are you doing to your enzymes' active sites?
Killing them,
exactly. So your enzymes are not able to help make those reactions run faster, and that means that we're doing the reaction without the help of the enzyme. So when you work harder, your body temperature heats up even more, right? So by killing your enzymes, you're making the problem even worse. We're gonna die when our body temperature gets around 108 degrees, so that's why pulling a temperature down if it gets higher and hotter is really important for enzyme function. So yeah, heat can kill those enzymes. It can denature or change the shape permanently. Okay, so plain everyday example. You cook eggs, right? Okay, when you cook it, can you ever put it back the way it was before as a liquid?
No.
Okay, that's denaturation, right? So you change the shape of that protein permanently. Enzymes can be natured, so can your other proteins. So what is the second thing there that can cause denaturation?
Acids,
right. So what is normal blood pH? Good. So in which direction would you head, below 7.35 or above 7.45 to hit an acid territory?
Below
7.35, yeah. We also don't live very long if our body's pH drops as low as 6.8. So the lower you go on that pH scale, the more we run into denaturation of those proteins. So acids and heat are two problems for proteins. Okay, and of course enzymes being a great example of that. All right, so in this picture here, can you spot for me the enzyme?
Lactase.
How did you know?
ASC.
Good. All right, and lactose, what is that?
Substrate,
good. And in fact, this particular substrate is what type of organic molecule?
Oh, that's a sugar.
Yeah, it's a sugar, good. How do you know that?
OSA,
good. Okay, so lactase is your enzyme, lactose is your substrate, it happens to be a sugar. They come together at your
active
site. Good.
Products.
Good. You broke it down into some products. So does this sound like a building or a breakdown reaction?
Breakdown.
Okay, so we're taking lactose, enzyme helps to activate it, and then we break it apart into something smaller. Okay, so yeah, this is a breakdown reaction. Would you call it catabolism or anabolism?
Catabolism.
Catabolism, good. Okay, so far so good? All right, last page for us is page 24.
Did you ever have an enzyme would never be part of the product, right? Because an enzyme would just, its function is just to break down?
Yeah, you're right. It would never be part of the product because it's kind of like, it's above and beyond the reaction. Yeah, that's a really good point.
On page 22, do we need to memorize the function of proteins, please?
I would generally know that the proteins that make your membranes are structural, and pretty much everything, it's instead of memorizing those, pretty much everything else is going to be functional. That helps you to have to do less work in memorization work.
Okay.
For structural proteins, most of them make up some part of your plasma membrane, as in the formation of a cell or a tissue or an organ, but everything else, looking at that list, serves as a functional protein. So if we say it's collagen, it makes up, you know, structure of a tissue. If we say it's a if we say it's a peripheral protein on a plasma membrane, those are structural in nature. Everything else is going to be functional. All right, so last category is called our nucleic acid category. The building block here is called a
nucleotide.
Good. So keep in mind the word nucleotide, nucleic acid, all sounds very familiar. Amino acids are not the building blocks here. They're the building blocks for the proteins. So a lot of terminology that can be very easily confused. Each nucleotide has three components, a phosphate group,
sugar,
and
an nitrogen space.
Good. Now I'll flip and show you one in just a minute. I'm just waiting to make sure you guys have a chance to copy down anything you'd like. Anybody still need the slide? Okay. So here is your typical DNA molecule. Each DNA molecule is built from building blocks known as nucleotides. Nucleotides have three parts. The P here represents your phosphate group. The S represents a particular sugar. This one is a 5-carbon. Good. What's the name of it? Yeah, deoxyribose. Good. So DNA, of course, the D in DNA stands for deoxyribose. How do you know deoxyribose is a sugar?
Ribose.
Yeah, OSC, right. So that's a great clue to look for there. The reason we call it a 5-carbon is if you take a look at this one that says S, there is, in fact, 5 sides to that. It's a pentagon-shaped sugar. So nonetheless, that's where we get the name 5-carbon sugar from. The nucleotide also has a nitrogenous base or nitrogen-containing base, and there's actually 4 different types here. They represent the base with G for guanine, or what about C?
Cytosine.
How about A?
Adenine
or T?
Thymine.
Good. Do you recognize these dotted lines? Yeah, hydrogen bonds. Good. So you'll notice guanine and cytosine pair with three sets of hydrogen bonds, and adenine and thymine pair with only two sets of hydrogens. Okay? So what you've got is our DNA and RNA molecules are built from repetitious nucleotides. ATP is actually a totally different beast. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But our genetic molecules have a pattern here to the way that these nucleotides are arranged. So what do you know about the structure of a DNA molecule? It's a helix. Good. How many strands?
Two.
Two strands. Good. What are the base pairing rules?
Adenine, thymine, and guanine.
Good. A's and T's, T's and A's. That's adenines and thymines. Thymines and adenines go together. And yeah, you're right. G's and C's and G's go together. That's guanine and cytosine, or cytosine and guanine that pair together. RNA is similar to DNA, but RNA is kind of like a copy of DNA. It's used for a specific process called protein synthesis. Good. So how many strands is your RNA molecule?
One.
It's one strand. Any differences in the base pairs? Yeah, uracil replaces thymine. Okay, so uracil is slightly different there, but nonetheless, it still pairs with what?
A.
Good, so it still pairs with adenine. And one more slight difference is the sugar. This time we have a different 5-carbon sugar known as
ribose.
Yeah, so D for deoxyribose in DNA. RNA, the R stands for ribonucleic acid, ribose, of course, being the sugar here. Okay. So when we talk about protein synthesis, that'll probably be next week sometime, or actually that Wednesday when we come back, we'll talk about why DNA and RNA are going to be working together. Our last type of nucleic acid is this one here. It's called ATP. It stands for adenosine triphosphate. Okay, so that's a mouthful to keep straight, and you may wonder why in the world this one is placed in the same category as DNA and RNA. You got it. It's got the same components, right, of any typical nucleotide. So what are the three parts of your typical nucleotide? Yeah, phosphate. In fact, hey, there's three. Okay? You got a sugar this time. It's ribose. And which nitrogenous base do we have?
Adenine.
Good. So you may wonder why this strange one is put in with the category of DNA and RNA. And it's entirely based on the fact that we're working with the same building blocks of nucleotides. So what does ATP do for us?
Energy.
It's energy, right. It has a sidekick known as ADP, also a nucleic acid. And even in Bio-211, we'll talk about AMP. So we've got one phosphate, two or three, which is the best way to go. Okay. So that should take us down to the bottom of page 24. What you've got left here is a worksheet on 25, 26, and 27. I just want to mention again, I'm not going to be here Wednesday. I'll be at a conference. I'd like you to read over pages 31 and 32. Let me go ahead and give you the blanks on the bottom of 31 and page 32 so you have everything you need. Okay, bottom of page 31 there, you've got a little bit of info on lysosomes to fill in. There are two functions down there, two bullet points. One, they destroy or recycle worn-out organelles. Okay, and secondly, those lysosomes help digest materials brought in. Let's see, looks like we have a couple of blanks on the next page. Mitochondria, over there you've got the cellular respiration chemical reaction. And glucose and oxygen are the reactants for this chemical reaction. I know you don't have a lot of room to write there. ATP is the main product that we're looking to create. We also create a waste product called CO2 and some water. Okay, so that's the top of the page 32, mitochondria under the function. And it looks like under the centrioles, there's two blanks to fill in. These centrioles make basal bodies that give rise to cilia and flagella. Those centrioles give rise to cilia and flagella. Okay, so if you like, you may want to put those on the flashcards, get that stuff to stick. And what we'll do on Wednesday when I come back after Memorial Day is we'll work on the beginning of this chapter. We'll work on protein synthesis, DNA replication, and membrane transport that day. All right, y'all have any questions?
I'll see y'all on the day.